Sunday, the 31st of August 2014. Prime Minister Tony Abbott points to the enemy.
We've seen what they can do. We've seen the beheadings, the crucifixions, the mass executions. This is pure evil.
And to the difficult road ahead.
We have to accept that the Middle East is a witch's brew of complexity and danger.
And what road is that exactly? Well, Foreign Minister Julie Bishop has given a clue.
We have a responsibility to ensure that we can combat this barbaric, brutal form of terrorism.
Combat, I see. This is the 9pm Road to War. Well, actually, war is good for quite a few things, really. War is great for the economy. Governments ramp up defence spending. In Australia during World War II, for example, defence spending rose to 35% of GDP. All of that money flows through the economy, so war is great for businesses, large and small. War is great for personal ambition. People rise through the ranks of the military much faster than in peacetime, and not only because people ahead of them get shot. Gold braid for everybody. And war gives young people something to do, teaches them some discipline or some such bullshit. War is great for technology. Innovation goes into overdrive, hyperdrive even. Good old evolution through natural selection happens bloody fast when the selection process is death. War is great for public administration. All sorts of embarrassing documents can just disappear. All sorts of otherwise difficult policies can be pushed through Parliament because, well, it's the war, don't you know? War is great for the entertainment industry because it saves them having to think up their own goddamn plots for novels and movies. And there's plenty of stories to fill news bulletins too. Either this spectacular use of technology, or our brave men and women, or the subhuman atrocities of the official bad guys. And finally, war is great for the political leadership. War leaders do great in the opinion polls. Even Australia's current batch of ARSAT political leaders know how good war is, and that's why we're edging ever closer to another war in the Middle East. Yes, it's back to Iraq, with added Syria. And as Crikey's Canberra correspondent Bernard Keane observed this week, it's looking a lot like the lead up to the Iraq War 11 years ago. For example, stage one is about hyping the threat. Remember Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction? Well, we don't have any imaginary nukes this time, but we do have the hyping of the threat posed by the Islamic State, formerly ISIS, formerly ISIL, formerly Phil Collins. Tony Abbott painted the Islamic State in the correct colour of evil this week and then talked up the need for military intervention.
We have to accept that the Middle East is a witch's brew of complexity and danger, but where there are clear evils that can be averted through international action, well then I think the international community does have a responsibility to consider that action.
I do like international action as a euphemism, don't you? Well, Abbott is singing from the same hymn sheet as the US, of course. Here's what US Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said about ISIS.
They have no standard of decency. Of responsible human behavior, and I think the record's pretty clear on that. So yes, they are an imminent threat to every interest we have, whether it's in Iraq or anywhere else.
It's a phase shift in the political discourse on Iraq, if I may use a phrase like political discourse. Going back to Iraq, in a military sense, was one of those unthinkable unthinkables until very recently. Now, it's a thinkable unthinkable, possibly even a thinkable thinkable. Here's what retired General Jack Keane, now a Fox News commentator, said on Fox News.
Quite frankly, at many national security commentators, even on Fox, did not want to go back into Iraq. This is an historical Shia-Sunni conflict. We shouldn't be involved. We don't want to be involved in Iraq's political struggles. We cannot provide an air force for Iran's Shia militia. All of those concerns, some of them well-founded, are trumped now by what? They are trumped by the seriousness of ISIS. ISIS is attacking U.S. vital interests in the Middle East, and they're willing to attack and kill American people and people in the West, in the UK and others in Europe. This is a fact, we know it, and we are now going to do something about it, probably reluctantly, begrudgingly, but we will eventually put together a comprehensive plan to deal with this because we do not have an alternative.
We do not have an alternative, I see. Now, as this is all unfolding, I worry about Mr. Rabbit's fetish for the military. He's listed the opportunity to work out with soldiers as one of the highlights of his time in office. There's a fetish, too, with kiddie military language like Operation Budget Repair, for fuck's sake. He seems to need to be seen as a man of action, like a kind of second-rate Vladimir Putin. I suspect we'll see more of Action Rabbit emerge in coming days because he's seemingly keen to get Australia into a war, where he can be Major General Tony Shit Happens Abbott, I suppose. Also a worry is Abbott's apparent need to be pleasingly subservient in all of these combat activities. Combat in scare quotes there. I hope you heard them. And the idea that, you know, General Abbott would win in the polls. So I suppose we shouldn't really be surprised by this. Tony Abbott has been very clear about the limits to his actions in winning at politics. Quote, "The only thing I wouldn't do is sell my ass, but I'd have to give serious thought to it." Well, Abbott may not want to sell his ass to remain Prime Minister, but I suspect he'd be perfectly happy to sell your sons and daughters in a dodgy war. Abbott also sends in Soap Eater, help Muslims stop the mostly fantasy threat of radicalisation. But apparently, sending the Attorney General in to help Catholicism stop pedophiles, no, that doesn't quite rate a mention, does it? Onward, Christian soldiers, marching, as the song goes, to war. Hello, I'm Stilgherrian. Welcome to The Edict. The promises I'm... Is my voice sounding a bit like the depths of a cupboard today? I suspect it is a little bit. I'm recording in a very cupboard-like environment with varnished surfaces. The environment, not me. No varnish on my surfaces. The promises I make in this podcast aren't worth the paper they're written on. Last time, I said the next episode, which is this episode, would be in 2 weeks. Alas, this did not come to pass. That morning, I tweeted, "I love food poisoning. There shall be no episode of the 9pm Edict today. I will continue to shiver and writhe in pain instead." I suppose I could have recorded an episode called The 9pm Explosive Diarrhea. That would have brought you some interesting sounds. Except it would have been more like The 2am to Sunrise Explosive Diarrhea, followed by a second episode called The Morning of Shivering. Not nice. But despite all that, I survived. The podcast survived. Well, it is surviving in the sense that it's happening as I speak now, though it will have happened by the time you listen to me, having had spoken. Here we are, anyway, with a second episode for August as intended. What happens in September? Well, stay listening and you'll find out. Why are there even different kinds of toothbrush? Why do we need them? It's now 9 days since Scott Morrison, Australia's Minister for Being a Cunt to Other People, gave evidence under oath before the Australian Human Rights Commission. And he began by sulking that the previous 6 immigration ministers hadn't been asked to give evidence yet. All those Labor politicians. Yes, because like every other aspect of the coalition government's work, it's all Labor's fault. Cue the sound of more party political cannon fodder thinking that's a partisan statement. No, you twats. Morrison is Immigration Minister today, so he gets the joy of answering questions about the current state of play. This does not exclude the possibility of the predecessors being asked at another time. And to be perfectly honest, if you asked why you're being a cunt to people, I don't think it's an acceptable answer to say that the other lot were cunts too, but we're just not quite as cuntful about it. The next thing Morrison did was a whiny, "Well, why don't you think of the burden on us?"
There is no decision that I or any of my predecessors take as a minister in this area that is not free of moral burden. Our decisions affect people's lives. It is a heavy responsibility that no minister carries lightly, regardless of their political affiliation. Unlike commentators, as a minister does not have the luxury of an opinion for which there are no consequences.
Oh, I know. I'm a parent too, aren't I? I've got emotions too, but I'm doing my duty. It is such a moral burden. Morrison seems to genuinely believe that he's the moral hero in all this. He argued that maintaining the integrity of the policy framework is the important thing. But no, that's the problem. There's some weird inhuman mental compartmentalization going on here. Treating people humanely is an important value, a Christian value even, Morrison might say, but except when it threatens the integrity of the policy framework. It was painful stuff to listen to. Now, the bit in all this evidence that seems to have gotten the most media coverage was when the Human Rights Commissioner, Professor Gillian Triggs, equated the detention facilities on Christmas Island with a prison, something that Morrison took exception to.
Any analysis that is either locked detention or a prison,
well,
whatever
word... You would have been to many jails and prisons.
Indeed.
And are you suggesting that Long Bay Jail is the same as a pool-fenced alternative place of detention at Phosphate Hill on Christmas Island?
I would like to move on, but basically, I have been a practicing lawyer since I was 22 years old, and I've been to many prisons, and I know a prison when I see it.
Well, Madam President, I've just asked you. Mm-hmm. You've said that these places are prisons. Now, you've been in prisons, so you're telling me that the Phosphate Hill compound on Christmas Island is the same as Long Bay Jail.
I'm not saying they're equivalent. I'm saying that
we can move
prison
on then,
facilities.
I think, Madam President.
Thank you.
What you can't see in this audio recording is Morrison sitting back at that point with a smug near-eye-one look on his face for scoring a debating point against the Commissioner, because that's the pathetic playground lens through which politicians observe the world. Did I win the debating point today? What doesn't seem to have gotten as much media coverage is Professor Trigg's persistent questions asking for evidence that the mandatory detention policy is what has persuaded asylum seekers to try their luck other than in Australia.
How can you justify detaining children in these conditions for more than a year when there's no evidence that this is the policy that is stopping the boats, but rather Operation Sovereign Borders, however you define it, with three-star generals or civilian authorities, whatever name you put to it, the reality is that physical force and power has stopped these boats. I want to know why, on what moral and legal basis you are holding these children in terms of achieving that outcome in terms of your promise to the Australian public.
Well, I've already said in my testimony, Madam President, that for those who are held on the mainland or on Christmas Island, other than those who are subject to the offshore processing policy of arrival post July 19, it is our intention not to hold them in detention. It is our intention to get them out of detention, and that has been our practice, with over 500 having been removed from detention since we were elected. The offshore processing policy, though, Madam President, the offshore processing policy, which has a consequence of children also being subject to that policy and placed in those facilities offshore, which I note is not a subject of this inquiry, that policy of offshore processing, combined with all the others I've mentioned, has produced the results collectively combined that this government has been able to achieve.
A fascinatingly bureaucratic answer from Morrison there. And yet, to talk about these various actions having produced this outcome is to fall for that logical fallacy, you know, correlation is not causation. The Human Rights Commissioner did kind of poke around the edges of that question as well, but Morrison arced up, you know, they did these actions and then the world changed, so therefore they must have caused this result. It's fascinating, with a capital F, a capital C, that politicians continually fall for this sense of being in control of the destiny of the world just by changing some fiddly little bit around the edges at the arse end of the universe that is Australia. There's a very simple way to prevent children being in detention. That's to not put them there in the first place, or if the children already are in detention, to release them. Now, Morrison spent a lot of time discussing the numbers of that, but You just do it. You actually just do it. But no, somehow Australia has ended up having a debate about the precise degree of cruelty to inflict upon children under stress. Well, hint, guys, it's fucking well zero. Why is this even a question? Still, I suppose we do have to protect the integrity of the policy framework. Boats must be stopped. Whether it's this or that particular act of cunthood that finally stops those boats doesn't matter, right? It's the same sort of dehumanised thinking as that employed by a species of small annoying lapdog known as Tim Blair. That particular spongiform creature extruded a piece of half-assed, no, quarter-assed travel writing about a day trip to Muslim land, aka Lakemba, recently. Seriously, just what sort of turds would you have to be at the Daily Telegraph to deliberately misrepresent a place to stir up ethnic hatred? Exactly what sort of spineless prick would you have to be to work with those other people at the Daily Telegraph and not call them out on it? It's the Jobsworth mentality, I suppose. Yeah, I'd do something, but hey, it's more than my job's worth. I know this is wrong, but if I don't acquiesce to the escalating racism, then I might not be able to afford my SUV repayments, you pathetic, spineless fucking oxygen thieves. Happy days. It's thank you time. Thank you first to 7 of my Twitter followers for helping me determine the 3 key differences between Philip Ruddock and a mechanical duck. Philip Ruddock is the chief government whip in the House of Representatives here in Australia. He's previously been Attorney General and before that Minister for Immigration and Multicultural and Indigenous Affairs, and he's been in Parliament now for a total of 235 years. A mechanical duck is, well, it's a mechanical duck. What do you think it is? Now, what are these 3 key differences? Well, Tim Burgess says mechanical ducks don't sleep hanging suspended from the roof of a cave. Jules, aka Humpjay, says the mechanical duck has some compassion. Sean Kay says the duck is cute, the duck doesn't collect government superannuation, and children aren't afraid of the duck. So all 3 there, yes. Oberon's Ghost says the duck has the potential to develop empathy. Richard Chirgwin says the duck is entertaining company. And Peter Harrigan says the duck is not an ankle. Well played, sir. And Rick Heyman finally asks an important question. There's that many differences? If I may summarise all these responses, I think it means that most people would prefer to have a mechanical duck rather than Philip Ruddock. Which brings me to Cardinal George Pell. Now, what I want to know is when do we get to the scene where Cardinal Pell's head spins around and around and around and around and he vomits creme de menthe? And also, can we use Cardinal Pell as an actual Pell, that is, as a post or stake used as a target for practicing sword technique? These are important questions. Also important is the need... No, the heartfelt desire to thank all supporters who make this podcast possible. Today I'd like to thank new Schooner subscriber Joshua Mailman, and also very generous contributions from Matt Sincott Crocker, who's another of these people who knows too much, do not talk to him, John August, Stuart Young, Martin Barry, Richard Siggs of Network Presence. Network Presence is an Australian firm that does Linux hosting and internet services, and obviously their contribution means they're the best of such businesses in the entire galaxy, or at least until the end of this sentence, and someone else who is remaining anonymous. Gets thanks, not is the best business in the galaxy. Now, postcards, the latest version of the quote promise unquote that people who are owed postcards would get them by now. I am hopeless in this regard. Postage in general is a hopeless concept. Nevertheless, there shall be postcards soon, soon. If you would like to join all of those people and make them manifold in supporting this particular podcast, then please go to the Skank Media website at skank.com.au/subscribe to take out one of the subscription options. And /tip if you'd just like to make a one-off donation. So that's at skenk.com.au. And all of the rules and how's your fathers are explained over there. Now, I've been thinking about what this podcast is all about. And to a large degree, it's about anger. I think that's fair to say. So I was intrigued to hear the other day, although it was probably recorded months ago and I'm just catching up on my listening, but I listened to it nonetheless, Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast, the episode where his guest was Harry Shearer, who was one of the people behind Spinal Tap, did voices for The Simpsons, has a wonderful little radio program called Le Show, which you can get on a podcast. It's quite amusing and interesting. And he actually mentioned how he gets away with some of the things he talks about on that radio show, Le Show.
The good thing about doing this radio show is I don't have to have any concern about what people think. It's done totally for free.
Yeah.
I've done it for 30 years. It's done on this radio network in the States, which is non-commercial. So I've never even inquired or been required to know what the ratings are or anything like that. No. So I just do what I feel, you know. And whether you have any kind of sense of, against your better judgment, a belief that a new guy may be better or not, by the time they've been in for a couple of years, you know, oh God, same old shit. And so that generates a certain kind of anger.
Yeah.
And a lot of satirical humor comes best from anger.
Yeah.
You know, that's the best thing to channel. So that's the best way to channel anger, is just to, okay, all right now. Aiming at you.
So in the interests of more effectively channeling my anger into podcasts, I'm about to launch a month-long subscriber drive. Yes, a bit like community radio, or public radio, as the Americans call it, with the aim of turning this podcast into a weekly thing. So Tuesday the 2nd of September, that'll start, and it'll run through to the end of the month, and it'll have a name, Beg Timber or Scrounge Timber or something. Ms. Mountbank suggested Sept-scriber, which is kind of nice. And John O'Ferguson suggested Gimme Your Monies, You Cunts, which perhaps captures some of the spirit of the idea, certainly, though that'd be tricky to use on some service platforms. You'll find out which name I do go with on Tuesday. That's the 2nd of September, if you suffer short-term memory loss, because I did just tell you. There'll be some new subscriber options up on the website then, and maybe some dodgy ways to encourage you to encourage other people to give me money. There'll definitely be some specific targets to reach, and there'll be some mini edicts to keep you informed during the month. So that'd be an edictet, I suppose, or a dictum, an ordinance, a bull, like a papal bull, or a fatwa even. God, so many decisions to make. Anyway. Elephant stamp time. Must get some effects for that. Each episode of this podcast, I give an elephant stamp of approval to people who have been exceptional in the category of thinking. And I've got two elephant stamps to award today. The first goes collectively to the authorities of Somerville, South Carolina for, look, I'll let WCSC's Live 5 News explain it.
New at 11, a classroom assignment led to the arrest of a Somerville High School student this morning. Police were called in after he used the phrase, bought a gun to take care of business in a writing assignment.
Debbie, Alex Stone says he did write that sentence, but he and his mother tell me there is much more to the story. On the second day of school, freshman Alex Stone was suspended and arrested.
I don't want to go back to that school. I want to transfer or be homeschooled.
Stone says they were told to write a few sentences about themselves and a status, as if it were a Facebook page. He says in his status, he wrote a fictional story that involved the words gun and take care of business.
I killed my neighbor's pet dinosaur, and then in the next status I said, I bought the gun to take care of the business.
Now, the kid's mother has spotted the obvious problem here.
First of all, we don't have dinosaurs anymore.
Stone says his statements were taken completely out of context. Investigators say the teacher contacted school officials who notified police. His book bag and locker were searched today. A gun was not found.
What happened to freedom of speech?
Stone's mother says she is furious that the school did not contact her before her son was arrested. She says her son followed directions and completed an assignment.
If the school would have called me and told me about the paper and asked me to come down and discussed everything and at least get his point of view on the way he meant it, instead of, I never heard from the school, never. They never called me.
Stone and his mother say they understand the sensitive nature of what he wrote, but they say it was a rash reaction to an innocent situation.
And I regret it because they put it on my record, but I don't see the harm in it. I think there might have been a better way of putting it, but I think me writing like that, it shouldn't matter unless I put it out towards a person.
Yeah, Mr. Stone does seem to have the right idea here, but, you know, really this sort of independent thought must be stopped. Helpfully, the South Carolina police, or at least the police in Somerville, I can never get my head around American police structures, the police, anyway, have deployed a familiar tactic to discredit him.
Police say during their interaction with Stone, he was disruptive. Stone was arrested and charged with disturbing schools. Debbie, back to you.
Sujatha, thank you. Stone's mother says he's scheduled to return to school on Monday.
An elephant stamp to South Carolina and the community, the authorities of Somerville. A gun was not found. There's a sentence. And that charge, disturbing schools. Good thing they didn't have that in towns where I went to school. Our second elephant stamp goes to the young gentleman that New South Wales police discovered at about 2:15 p.m. on Tuesday, the 26th of August, 2014, in the suburb of Riverwood. Police attached to the St. George Proactive Crime Team. I'm not quite sure what that is. I think that they proactively commit crimes. The police meant to do that. In any event, the police sighted a vehicle, which is what police do instead of just seeing a vehicle, stopped in a designated no-stopping zone on Thurlow Street. That's obviously something worth investigating. It is alleged that when the officers approached the car, a 20-year-old man was sitting in the front passenger seat chopping up cannabis on a pee plate that was on his lap. Officers will further allege a search of the 19-year-old driver allegedly uncovered 4.3 grams of methamphetamine or ice and a small quantity of cannabis. Both men were granted conditional bail to appear before the Sutherland local court on Thursday, the 11th of September. So, yes, elephant stamp for excellence in thinking to the 20-year-old chap chopping up his cannabis in the front seat of a passenger car, front passenger seat of a car that was illegally parked. OPSEC, an operational security tip, try to hide your criminal activity. Just a tip. That's our elephant stamps for this episode. And now it's time for UberWatch, a new segment where we cast an eye over the work of our favourite disruptive libertarians, Uber, who do short-term car hire, but they're not taxis, except for the bits which are kind of taxis, except for the bits of that which are cars that are driven by people who kind of aren't taxi drivers. Disruption, which is just a big word for change. And changing the taxi industry isn't such a bad thing. As I pointed out back in April for ZDNet in a little yarn called Enjoy Your Ubergasm, But Don't Expect Respect in the Morning, I pointed out a few things. Actually, I might call this section Ubergasm, not Uberwatch. It's Ubergasm now. Ubergasm. In Paris, For example, there's just three taxis per 1,000 people. That's according to Frederic Filou of Monday Note. That's 3 per 1,000 in Paris compared to 13.5 in New York, 11 in London, 8 in San Francisco, 7 in Seoul, Korea. So that means with so few taxi drivers in Paris, that drives costs up, lack of competition means there's no incentive for drivers to provide good service, etc. Although I suppose they're French, so, you know, it's going to be like that anyway. Australian cities lack competition too. Sydney has, even fewer than Paris, 1.4 taxis per 1,000 inhabitants. And the ownership of those taxi plates is concentrated in just a few businesses. You can find out more about that on an ABC Radio National background briefing episode last year. So getting some competition into that would be a good thing, but in the rush to fix all the problems in the taxi industry, or any other industry for that matter, I reckon we need to avoid making three serious errors of logic that could land us somewhere worse. Error one, something must be done about this industry. This is something, therefore it needs to be done. Error two, the business and social models for the hyperconnected future will be radically different from industrial age models. This is a radically different business and social model, therefore it is the model for the hyperconnected future. And error three, current regulation doesn't work perfectly, therefore we should have no regulation. Now, it seems to me that Uber is a fine example of this kind of disruption at work, just kind of smashing random parts of the industry to get the bits that you can make profitable and really, you know, sod any care about anything else. Well, it's a business. It's working for its owner's benefit. That's what businesses do. But that's not necessarily for society's benefit. So I reckon we can have a jolly good Ubergasm over the coming episodes. Like this little Ubergasmette. No, I'm losing the metaphor here. The other day, PR columnist Ed Zitron tweeted, "Just had an Uber driver make me get in the front of his car because he didn't have the permit to stop off at San Francisco Airport." $16 billion company right here. Yes, yeah, make your passenger move. Uber is supposedly worth $16 billion, which is another little amusing little feature. And on Tuesday, The Verge wrote about Uber's playbook for sabotaging the rival transport firm Lyft, spelt L-Y-F-T because it's the internet and we can't spell things properly. It seems that Uber is arming teams of independent contractors with burner phones and credit cards as an attempt to undermine Lyft and other competitors. It has contractors called brand ambassadors, and what happens is that these Uber brand ambassadors request rides from Lyft and the other competitors, and then in the car recruits their driver. And the aim is that by the end of the journey, the driver is no longer working for Lyft but for Uber. And the Verge says this has already rolled out nationally by Uber and has already resulted in thousands of cancelled Lyft rides. And obviously that makes it difficult for them to get their business going. I thought competition was a good thing. Earlier this month, CNN reported that Uber employees around the US ordered and then cancelled 5,560 Lyft rides, according to an analysis by Lyft. What Lyft did, they cross-referenced the phone numbers of the users who tried to recruit Lyft drivers with users who'd previously cancelled rides. So they're seeing the same numbers turning up. Uber flatly denied trying to sabotage its competitor. Quote, "Lyft's claims against Uber are baseless and simply untrue." But apparently, since at least midsummer American time, which is a few months ago, I suppose. I don't know. Use month names, you stupid bastards. Some Uber brand ambassadors in New York have been working against Lyft using Uber-provided iPhones and credit cards and trying to do this whole strike-up conversation with the driver and get him to sign over to Uber. And The Verge's article shows the script that the brand ambassadors we should call just call them poachers, really, the Uber poachers, use to interview a driver. It's all charming stuff. Ah, I had a lovely Ubergasm. I think I might, from next week, start finding some music to put under some of those longer spoken segments, because I'm told that modern people are incapable of listening to talking unless there's also music with it. Fucking idiots. I was amused to see that the Australian Senate the other day, that the Labor Party brought on an urgency motion for the Senate to affirm support for Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act. Now, without going into the details of what that means, I just think the whole concept is a bit odd. It's apparently urgent that the Australian Senate now discuss just precisely how offensively racist you're allowed to be. Because that's Australia. And they're going to be thinking about the legislation which has to come into Parliament soon about the telecommunications metadata and the mandatory data retention regime and that whole political thing that is kicking off. Last episode, you heard Australia's favourite Attorney General, Senator George Brandis, QC, attempting to explain on television how the collection regime would be structured. And if you haven't listened to that yet, you should. But in quick summary, he fucked it up substantially. Look, I think we need to be clear about what's going on here. The Attorney General wants Parliament to pass a law that he himself can't even begin to explain. He's almost saying, oh, Australia should have a law based on something that cannot be defined but which can get you jailed. I'm the Attorney General. Why do you ask? Yet, like, no, that's not how it should work. And I think that calls for an edict. This is edict number 28. Whereas it is the task of elected lawmakers to make laws, which the rest of us must follow, and whereas the law is difficult enough as it is, if lawmakers do not understand a particular law, then they shall not vote for it. If they cannot explain the law in a live conversation on national television, they shall not vote for it. This edict implies that lawmakers must read the legislation they're voting on, all of it. This should be utterly uncontroversial. After all, it's your fucking job. Well, that's the edict for now. As usual, there's links to some of the things I mentioned on the podcast webpage. You can also leave a comment there. Just type some words, but even better, leave an audio comment. Skype to Stuhl Gerry on our phone, Sydney, +61 280 113 733, and record your thoughts. I'll rush through that because no one ever does it. Tuesday, that's the 2nd of September. Watch out for the subscriber drive and a mini fatwa bull proclamation pertaining thereto. The next full episode will appear on Friday, the 12th of September, or thereabouts. I'm Stuhl Gerry. See you then.